Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 14th. Let the record reflect it's 1:46. I'm going to apologize. Our caucus went late today. We had a very long caucus, and apologize for the delay of the meeting, which is very, very rare in this committee. Senator Schauer, Vice Chairman, is on his way down. We have Senator Hughes, Senator Meyer, Senator Keel with us, and of course myself, Chair Reinbold. Thanks, Kelly, Nancy, and Alex, as always. Appreciate you. Today we have three agenda items on the list today. So we have SJR1, we have definition of victims, which is one of a bill that my office is sponsoring, and we also have the governor's appointees that have been patiently waiting, and I want to get to them ASAP. So with that, we are going to just one second. Kelly, is there a certain order I need to go in? No. Okay. So with that, I like to do them in groups. So what we're going to do is we're going to do the Bar Association first, and so we will be starting with Rick Castillo. Can you hear us, Rick?
Yes, I can hear you, Senator.
Okay.
Thank you. How are you? Good day.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your patience. I'm really sorry that caucus was delayed today. But if you could just state your name, affiliation, and then the reason you would like to be on the Board of Governors to the Alaska Bar, that would be terrific. And the floor is yours.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Ricardo Castillo, but most people know me as Rick. Senator of the Judicial Committee, I'd like to begin by stating it's an honor for me to be considered for this appointment, and I hope I serve it well. Just real briefly about me, I was born in Lakewood, New Jersey, spent many of my years in Maridon, Florida, and most people don't even often know where that is, but it's pretty much where NASA launches shuttles and rockets from. I have great memories of Space Coast, and I feel fortunate to be inspired by where I grew up and the time period it was in. In the 90s, my mom worked hard as a contractor for McDonnell Douglas on the NASA campus, and she indeed raised three children on her own, so I'd have to say that whatever resiliency and motivation that I have today often reflects the years of hardships that probably we endured together as a family. In 2007, I was brought to Alaska by the way of U.S. Army, where I was stationed with the 425th Airborne Brigade Combat Team, and I served with the 1st and 501st here at Fort Richardson, Alaska. My time in service taught me a lot about myself, about servant leadership, integrity, but unfortunately, it also showed me what brokenness looked like and the cognitive dissonance that many service members struggle with after coming back from combat deployments. In 2011, I left active duty Army, and I spent the next few years in the Alaska National Guard while attending the University of Alaska. Since then, I've served in several capacities within the private sector, to include transportation, distribution, oil and gas, telecommunications. As it became more and more apparent that my wife and I was building our future and our home in Alaska, I had a strong desire to want to know my community intimately, learn more from Alaskans, and learn as much as I could about the great state. I chose to shed some of those battle-hardened layers acquired through the Army and try to gain some unique perspective of Alaska through several organizations, such as Leadership Anchorage with the Alaska Humanities Forum, which took me as far as Upiabik, where I was humbled to do a workshop in breaking down communication barriers in different generations with the Eben Hobson middle schoolers. I served as a PTA member at Northern Lights ADC to do what I could to help advance children's education, and I had also served as an advisor to my collegiate fraternity chapter in helping to build the character among young men. I've also fundraised some money for Rotarians for nonprofits around the city and the state through Rotary Hillside. Fun fact, I ate my first real moose nugget in an attempt to raise a large sum of money for an annual fundraiser. And as long as it's good and it gets washed down with a beer, I guess I'm willing to do anything for charity. So, furthermore, in 2020, I was a candidate for Anchorage Assembly in District 6, and after losing that election, I think it really inspired me. After, of course, being very encouraged by it, it inspired me to go out and do a little bit more that I could to be an advocate for the people and to continue to serve. So, Senators, as a 14-year Alaskan resident, it's just my desire to want to serve the state and serve the Alaska Bar Association as I seek this appointment. And to be able to express and represent the ideals and values that are inherent to the people of Alaska. To me, the Alaska Bar Association is the agency that establishes, of course, the curriculum that provides credentials to attorneys and allows them to practice law in the state of Alaska. I believe that attorneys should be fully vetted and trustworthy, mainly because we've seen how bad actors can reduce the consumer confidence in law in our state. I'd appreciate your confirmation today in this appointment, because I do believe that as a public member appointed, I'll be able to serve unbiasedly and represent the diversity of the public and the industries that they represent that would help formulate best practices within the bar. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Okay, Senator Kill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Castillo, thanks for volunteering. Two lines of questions. The first is, I appreciate your resume, very thorough and helpful. Can you tell us about, I noticed you listed COVID Secure, which I think is a COVID app. Can you tell us about your work with that?
Yes, Senator, through the chair. I have a consulting firm, and I was brought on with COVID Secure LLC to provide development and IT solutions to further expand and better formulate what we do within providing those solutions. So to optimize and to make efficient.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, if I might, that
go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, and that just the purpose of that app, what does that do?
Currently, it's used to power the travel portal through the state of Alaska. It's also used amongst the healthcare industry as the electronic health record application that allows clinicians across the nation to do vaccinations optimally and efficiently.
Thank you. And then, if I may, Madam Chair?
Please, Senator Keel.
Thank you. Then, on a different line of inquiry, I notice you talk about your consulting firm, and you mention a number of fields of endeavor, one of which is lobbying. Can you talk to us about where you lobby, and are you able to give us to disclose any lobbying clients?
Senator, through the chair, no formal lobbying. I've worked on bills, and I've worked to help strengthen some of the narratives behind state bills to advocate on the behalf of supply chain solutions or veterans issues.
And I ask, just follow up, Madam Chair. I ask because I didn't see a lobbyist registration. Can you help with that?
Yeah, not within the state of Alaska, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Did Senator Shower, did I see your hand?
No, but I haven't asked him my standard question.
Okay. Do you want to do that? Because we're running way
behind. You got
today,
it. So. I'll make it quick. Rick, it's Senator Shower. We've talked before a few times, different issues. Really quickly, I just asked some generic questions, so yes or no is good enough, unless you need to expound on them. Basically, have you read the ethics laws for the state? Is there any criminal, civil, or other type actions in your background that are not mentioned here we'd like to know about? And the final catch-all, just so we've asked the questions for due diligence for the public record, any skeletons in your closet that we would want to know about that we would not find out until later that we would have regrets? Thank you.
Senator, through the chair, no.
Okay, thank you. And I'm going to go ahead now and take a turn. Rick. It says Ricardo. It also says Rick. So anyway, I just wanted to echo off of what Senator Keel was talking about. You do the travel portal with the COVID. Was that a contract with the state?
Senator, yes, that was a contract through the state, not by my own initiative, of course. I do not. I'm not the CEO of COVID Secure in that capacity. So I have no action or speak at the table for when it comes to state contracts.
However, you were being paid, correct?
Senator, yes, I am being paid through COVID Secure LLC.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. And then the second question I have that you know, is your resume is very impressive, and I think you did a great job representing yourself. However, I have a real concern with this. Enforce safe classroom routines consistent with parameters guided for the CDC. I'm assuming that's masks and social distancing and all that stuff that's stressing all the kids out. Is that right?
Senator, could you repeat your question, please?
What are you doing when it says enforce classroom routines consistent with the parameters for CDC for COVID-19? What are you doing?
That was probably, we're providing at Solutions, we provide any type of COVID-19 testing that may be required for students to enter into the Anchorage School District after travel.
So PCR testing you're giving to children at basically just when they traveled?
Senator, as the state portal and through the Anchorage School District, this is not dictated by the application and the electronic health record itself, but by the school district, that children have a negative COVID test upon entry within the school district after travel.
Okay, I always consider that a punishment for travel. But anyway, are you doing anything else? Are you doing any of the social distancing or mask enforcement that's stressing the kids out at school?
Senator, we do not have any ability to dictate what happens at the school district level. I believe that's at the Acres School Board and within the superintendent.
Okay, so the only thing you're doing, because you say you're enforcing safe classroom routines amongst students, so I would just assume that you were enforcing masks and, you know, making them stay apart and, you know, kind of all the things that are stressing the kids out. Is that an accurate?
No, I'm sorry, Senator. You're reading from a substitute line as a substitute for the Anchorage School District. No, not enforcing, being complicit with what school board regulations in the school district are.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Rick, for being with us today. We're going to take public testimony shortly. You are welcome to stay on, but first I will take William Granger, also with the Board of Governors for the Alaska Bar. So, William, please state your name, affiliation, and the reason you want to be part of this board.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Bill Granger. I'm a lifelong Alaska resident of Anchorage and have been on the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association for, pushing 20 years maybe. There was a three-year when I was not appointed, but other than that, I think about 2000. Most of the time, my involvement with the board on an official basis has been that of treasurer. I'm a financial guy, as you can see by my resume. I've been a banker for my entire life. I'm currently retired, but nonetheless still actively involved in the financial area. And so that's what I do professionally. I enjoy the board. I enjoy the camaraderie, the intellectual challenge. I've always been fascinated by the law. In high school, I spent most of my time in the law library. I was a little of a nerd back then with white shirts and ties all the time. And being involved in the Board of Governors, I think, is a very important role for the public members. There are three public members on the board. The rest of them are all members of the Bar Association, scattered throughout the state, most of them in Anchorage. The board turns over about 25% every year. This year, the board has lost its longtime executive director, Deborah Regan. I think had been there for 37 years. So I think an important role that I fulfill, even with Deborah being there, is that of continuity. If you have a governing body that turns over completely every 3 years, it gets a little hard to maintain continuity if it does in fact turn over that rapidly. Sometimes people will stick around for another appointment, but not always. So that continuity factor, I think, is very important in making sure that we apply the various rules and practices that we have established over a long period of time with the guidance of the Supreme Court. And my ability to maintain the financial stability of the organization, I think, was also important. We've gone for a long period of time without raising dues, and yet have managed to scrape by and save enough money to recently purchase the building which we have previously leased in downtown Anchorage. So we're now the proud owners of an office building on the Park Strip. And that was quite an accomplishment. I anticipate that that will result in substantial savings to our membership as the years go by. And there's also several other financial things that I'm looking forward to tackling in this next coming couple of years. So with that, I would appreciate your recommendation or reappointment, and we'll answer any questions you might have.
Anyone have any questions?
Thank you.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make it quick. Bill, you might have heard my questions for Rick previously. I ask everybody same questions, and I'll just go quickly. First one, does you or have you read, and I know you have, but I'm going to ask it for public record. It's been a couple of years since you've been in front of a board. You have read the ethics laws for the state, correct?
That is correct.
And then just in the meantime, since it's been a few years, have you any civil or criminal type actions that have not been listed here that we might want to know about? And my final catch-all question, are there any other skeletons that might be in the closet now that we would want to learn about today to discuss prior to your confirmation?
No, sir. I don't have any issues, no pending, threatened lawsuits, criminal actions of any type. And, you know, I don't know of any skeletons. Well, you know, I mean, everybody has something. But, you know, no, sir, I don't think there's anything you will be embarrassed by.
Thank you for being with us today, William. We have three more appointees we are going to get through. We're going to do public testimony all together to save time today. And so you are welcome to stay online or go on with your business today. With that, thank you for being willing to serve. We are now moving on to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. And I really want to say we have had a lot of appointees in this Judiciary Committee. And these are our final three, I believe. So anyway, just want to say thank you to the committee members for working hard on so many appointees, and my staff for ensuring that they are all lined up and ready to go. So with that, we are going to start with James Rhodes. James, speak your name, affiliation, and why you'd like to serve on the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission.
My name is James Rhodes. I'm not sure what you mean by affiliation. I have served on the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, and I feel that there's great value in the experience that you gain on that commission, and I would like to continue to serve and gain more experience and put the experience that I have gained to work on that commission.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Go ahead, Mike, Senator Schauer.
Thank you. So you might have heard my questions before. If you did, I'll expedite them. But the first one, I ask it just of everyone with no specific indications that you have any of these, but have you read the state ethics laws?
Yes.
And then any civil criminal type things in your background we would want to know about, and any other skeletons in the closet that we would want to know about now that we could debate before your confirmation that may not have been disclosed that we would want to know about?
I have nothing in my past that would be of any concern related to my appointment to the commission.
Thank you.
Thank you, James, for being with us today. We appreciate it. Next, we're moving on to Amy Steele. I think you know the routine. Amy, please proceed.
Yes. Okay, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Amy Steele. I currently reside in Anchorage. I've been serving as an employer representative for the Appeals Commission since June of 2019. I feel I have an extensive work history in workers' compensation, which is unique, and it allows me to bring beneficial, relevant knowledge and perspective to the commission. I was previously an industry member of the Workers' Compensation Board from 2011 through 2019. I have over 20 years' experience in insurance risk management, specifically workers' compensation. I've had the opportunity to oversee and manage claims throughout the United States. and overseas, giving me a wide range of knowledge about multi-jurisdictional workers' compensation law. I currently work for one of the native corporations overseeing our auto and workers' compensation claims, assisting our employees with the process and the benefits. And to answer Senator Schauer's questions, I have read and am familiar with the ethics policy of the state. I don't have any civil criminal skeletons or anything that would be of any concern. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your consideration.
Amy, it sounds like you knocked it out of the park. I think we're good, and I don't see any questions. So next, thank you for being with us, and thank you for your patience, and I'm sorry we were delayed. With that, we have, yes, and we appreciate your great experience you're bringing to the table. I was quite impressed with the amount of experience you had. It seems like this is a really appropriate board for you. With that, we're going to move on to Deirdre Ford. Deirdre, if you can state your name and the reason you want to serve on the Workers' Compensation Appeals, we would sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Deirdre Ford. I am currently chair of the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. I was appointed in 2016 by Governor Walker to fill the unexpired term of the previous chair. And then in 2019, Governor Dunleavy appointed me to a full 5-year term. My late husband and I came to Alaska in 1978, and I consider Alaska to be paradise. This state of Alaska enabled me to go to law school from 1981 to 1984, and I was in private practice primarily representing employers and workers' compensation cases from 1985 to 2009. And then in February of 2009, I became a hearing officer before the Alaska Workers' Compensation Board. I retired in 2012 when I remarried, and then in 2016, I was asked to come out of retirement and apply to be chair, and I applied, and as I said, Governor Walker appointed me. I have thoroughly enjoyed my work both before the Workers' Compensation Board and before the commission. It is truly delightful after years in practice to sit on the other side of the bench, so to speak, and watch attorneys make the arguments I should have made or make the same mistakes I made, and it's very enlightening and informative, and I work with a wonderful set of commissions, and the clerk of the commission is an outstanding employee for the state of Alaska. I have read the ethics rules. There's several that you need to read when you're chair of the commission, including the state's ethics and the court ethics and the administrative law judge ethics. So I have read those. And to answer the rest of your questions, I know of no skeletons in my closet that I would be embarrassed to have before the committee, and I have no pending charges or convictions or any of whatever your other questions were. The answers to those were no. And I would appreciate continuing my work.
Well, excellent. I believe it's Deirdre Ford. Thank you so much for being with us. There's no questions at this time. You were concise, to the point, and I actually really enjoyed hearing that you enjoy and are amused and learn from this commission, and I'm really pleased that you're willing to continue with your experience, and congratulations for your chairmanship. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony on all of these appointees. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? There is nobody online that is asked to testify. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close testimony. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In accordance with AS 3905080, the Senate Judiciary Standing Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar, Rick Castillo, Anchorage. Bill Granger, Anchorage. Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, Deirdre Ford, Anchorage. Amy Steele, Anchorage. James Rhodes, Ketchikan.
And I'd like to remind members that signing the reports regarding appointees to boards and commission does not reflect the individual's member to approve or disapprove the appointees. The nomination are merely forwarded to the full legislature for confirmation or rejection. With that, we will be taking a brief at ease to sign paperwork. And once again, thank you for everybody for being online and your patience today. And congratulations. We're back on the record. I'm up for our second agenda item on today's calendar. And with that, I'm going to welcome my staff and our committee aide, Kelly Toth. If you could please come and discuss SB 122, the victim, the definition of victim. It's sponsored by my office, and my wonderful staff is doing an incredible job at my office, Kelly Toth. And I know you'll put your name in the, and affiliation on the record anyway, but couldn't help myself. Thank you. Please proceed.
Senator Reinbold, Chair of Judiciary, thank you all members for hearing our bill today. My name is Kelly Toth. I'm staff to Senator Reinbold. We'll be introducing SB 122. It is the victim definition bill. SB 118 is a bill that removes the word adult in the definition of a victim, which is in AS 12.55.185. Subsection C.II. This bill, the removal of the word adult is to make it consistent and equitable with the rest of this part of the definition. This bill includes a child if a person who has been a victim of a crime and is now deceased in the legal definition of a victim, it will allow the child to participate in the case in the same way as a victim themselves would have been if they were not deceased. And so in your packet, you'll see there is a fiscal note. It's a zero fiscal note. And if you would like, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to walk through the sectional.
Excellent. And I would also like you to know, it looks like, did we notice public testimony on this bill?
We did.
Okay, so there's public testimony, but we also have Taylor Winston, Office of Victims Rights, that is available if you need them. And please proceed with the sectional.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so it's... really quite simple. You'll see there's just one section, and the change is on page 2, line 1 in subsection II. You'll see that the two words "an adult" have been deleted and inserted the word "a" so that it reads "a child, parent, brother, sister, grandparent, or grandchild of the deceased."
Shortest sectional of all time. I had 29 sections yesterday, so that was brutal. Anyway, do we have any questions of committee members at this time? Okay, would you like me to call on invited or open public testimony? She invited public testimony, Taylor, or she?
Madam Chair, she is invited testimony.
Invited testimony. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and have Taylor Winston at this time. Taylor, can you hear us? Welcome to Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson Reinbold, for this opportunity to speak briefly on this change, this amendment to the definition of a victim.
Could you state your name and affiliation, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you. Taylor Winston, Executive Director of the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights. We noted in our office probably over a year ago that there was a disparate treatment of children under this definition compared to other folks defined in the definition of a victim. And within the last 6 to 8 months, it's actually become an issue in a case. It was resolved through another matter, but it certainly pointed out a difficulty that exists. And as I mentioned, the disparate treatment that a child can receive by being currently eliminated unless they are an adult under the definition and therefore precluded from the constitutional rights and statutory rights that crime victims have in our state when the parent is a homicide victim. And as you can see by reading the statute, that it doesn't give an age qualifier to the brother, sister, or grandchild at all of a deceased person, or even the spouse for that matter. And as, you know, strange as it might seem, there could be a situation where someone is deceased and their spouse is a minor, you know, 17 and a half years old. And the child, though, a child of a similar type situation couldn't give a victim impact statement or couldn't receive restitution or any number of the other rights that are given to crime victims in the state. Similarly, like a sister A person could actually be deceased and have a minor sister and a minor child, and the sister would be able to have all the protections of those rights, but the deceased person's child wouldn't. So this is just to make it equitable and to eliminate the disparate treatment in the law.
Excellent. Very clear and concise. I want to see if any committee members have any questions. It does not look – oh, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Winston, excuse me, thanks for your work and support of the bill. As I read the bill, I wonder if there may be an unintended consequence that could be fixed with just some drafting shift, because 19C says one of the following. I appreciate you pointing out the issue with a minor sibling of a victim, I guess I worry, because it's just one, do we create a situation where a homicide victim who has a very, very young minor child might not have anyone who could give a meaningful victim impact statement or participate in parole hearings or the other things that a victim is entitled to participate in?
Well, I mean, in answering your question, Senator, through the chair, this is Taylor Winston again on that question. That could be a situation that existed with any and all the people contained within the definition of a victim. Potentially, you could have somebody who is an adult child who's incompetent, or adult brother who's incompetent and then couldn't make the same statement or utilize the laws and the protections that are available to them in the same way someone in a similar situation as far as relationship might be able to. So this just allows, and hopefully I understand your question correctly, this just allows that there's not a barrier put up simply because of someone's age as to access crime victim rights in the state of Alaska. And I have had children, very small children, who've wanted to participate, and frankly, most courts have allowed it, although in the situation I've had little children participate, it's been in victim impact statements. The issue that arose in a case I had recently had to deal with a separate victim right issue. But, for the most part, kids do often want to participate even when they're quite young. And I don't worry too much about notification because I think that's why the Department of Law may put a zero fiscal note, because there is usually an adult attached with that child, either a guardian ad litem, somebody through OCS, some other mechanism for which notification may be fairly normalized in any case.
Madam Chair, thank you. It sounds like there might be some additional cleanup of this section that might want to go along with the cleanup that the bill provides. It sounds like there are other issues that need to be addressed along with this, the good point behind the bill.
Okay, so I'll be making announcements for amendments, and we're not planning on moving this bill out today, so you can work with Taylor or my staff, Kelly. But yeah, we're in no rush to get this out, today. So, yeah. Okay. With that, Senator Schauer.
Just a question, a follow-up on Senator Keel's. I mean, it seems like C3, and have her comment on this, would be the catch-all for what you were asking. I may have taken the question differently, but it seems like that would be the safety net that would get any other interested person out of that. But I would be curious to see what she says to that, or if there's a different category we're missing.
Taylor, was that clear? Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator, through the chair. Yes, you would think so.
Right.
But I will tell you that it became a point of litigation, the word adult. And it was going to result in a situation where a teen child was not going to be able to avail herself of her crime victim rights because it said adult child when her mother had been murdered. And so I argued in pleadings that the court had the option of the triple I section of any other person, and the court declined to see it that way. So unfortunately, C triple I allows for discretion. And I think that if you think about the situation where a grandchild of a person would be given more rights, a minor grandchild, than their direct flesh and blood minor child, I hate to say it, but from a victim's rights perspective, it's offensive.
All right. Okay. So any other questions today? Senator Hughes.
I hope I'm not being repetitive, Madam Chair, but I don't know if there's a legal problem. I'm just looking at, I'm starting on line 12 with C. So we can only pick one of the following, right? So what happens if the person is a minor and married, so they were a spouse of the person who's deceased, so they're 17, by saying only one of the following? Do we need to change that language so it'd be any of the following? And then in the same way, under B, we're not adjusting the adult child thing in B double I or B2. Is there some reason why we're not adjusting that? This child.
Taylor, did you understand the question that there's not a triple I under the 19 B? And then is there a problem once again with the one of the following?
So it's the first question, Madam Chair, just to clarify, under C, if we have a spouse who is a minor, because C says one of the following, doesn't say one or more of the following, right? So if it only can fall under one of there, do we have a legal problem? And then a separate second question is, why are we not adjusting in line 10 the adult child, just a child?
Taylor?
Yes, thank you, Senator Hughes, through the chair. So I would agree with the senator that a better word starting with subsection C instead of one of the following would be any of the following, because it doesn't the laws, I don't think the intent of the law was to just say out of the communal group of people who are defined as victims, only one person would have an opportunity for restitution, or one person would have an opportunity to speak or attend a hearing. So I do think that the replacement of one with any would be better phraseology in this statute. Now, with regards to subsection B, of course, we once again have one of the following. But if a person is specified as a victim, so the crime to which happened to that person, as in A, so offender commits a crime against an individual person, B relates to A. And so if the person in A is a minor, which is already a minor, I guess technically you're right. There could be a situation where a minor is a parent and is affected, you know, by being perpetrated on as A. But the difference is the group in C all pertains to homicide victims. So if the actual victim of the crime has been a homicide victim and is deceased, then there's this whole pool of people who are remaining, who are alive, that are treated as victims under the law. Where in B, it is just trying to focus on if a person who is of a certain mental capacity has been the direct victim of an offender, that these other folks, like a spouse or an adult child or a parent, can also be a victim, not instead of, but in addition to. So I do think that the minor child is already covered through B. Because it is trying, that provision is trying to get to someone who also has some effects but can speak in all contexts for the person who's incapacitated or incompetent by legally or physically.
Senator Hughes.
So if you go up to line 7, it says minor, incompetent, or incapacitated. So we could have a mentally disabled adult who is the victim, and they're still alive, and they've suffered badly, and then they could have a child. They could have a minor child under double I that is impacted. So I think that we shouldn't have the word adult child there either, because it could be a minor that's associated with the victim, who may actually be adult, but they're incompetent or incapacitated.
And Senator Hughes, through the chair, I certainly understand your concern there. I think that I'm not saying that that's a good or a bad idea. If this committee and the legislature wants to expand the definition of all of the people much further who qualify as victims under the law, then that change could be made. But the real difference between B and C is that the actual victim is dead in C. I mean, the direct victim of the offender is dead in C. And therefore, there's a group of people that are recognized as victims. In B, the direct victim of the offender is not dead. They may be under 18. They may be mentally challenged. They may have fallen into a coma. There may be some other things, but they're not dead. And so then it's thought that there's somebody attached to that person that has full competency associated, related to the incompetent or legally incompetent person to come before the court. So I think it could be expanded, but it would very much expand the definition of victim.
And follow up?
Senator Hughes?
Well, it's an important policy call, because a victim who's actually murdered and it's a homicide, then you're allowing a child who wants to come before the court to say how they're impacted. That parent's going to be gone forever. The parent who's been victimized to the point where they weren't actually killed, but they're going to be in really bad shape, whether it's a coma or extremely disabled, incapacitated in a bad way, that child is in the first situation, yes, they've lost a parent, but they're going to maybe go now live with two whole adults, grandma and grandpa. In this situation, now that child is living with somebody who has been extremely harmed but still is alive, and if they're able to go before the court, I just don't understand why you would only allow the child if the parent were murdered, and you wouldn't allow it if the parent were harmed extremely badly. I mean, if the child's able to speak up and wants to, I don't understand why you would put it under one category and not the other. Am I missing something?
And again, Senator, through the chair, Taylor Winston, and I'm not saying that couldn't be done. But one might say if the child, because it's sort of changing the context a little bit of B and the intent of B. It's not a negative thing that it's changing it, but if you were to do that, one might then ask, well, then should the sister, brother, grandparent, potentially grandchild, I don't think there'd be a grandchild, but it might be, yes, there could be,
Should they also have those same opportunities in B as they do in C? I'm all for, as many people who are victimized and related to a victim having opportunity to participate in the process. So I don't have any objection from my standpoint. It just would potentially expand notification on all the things that I don't know that have so far been dealt with as far as fiscal notes impacts.
And I'm just going to just put this on the record before I take a couple more questions. This bill actually only does, and correct me if I'm wrong, Taylor, only on page 2, the only thing it does is take out an adult and put the letter A. Is that it? So a child, basically. So it deletes two words and adds an A. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Gill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senator Hughes hit an excellent point, and I guess the way I look at B is that the person who was the direct victim, the one who was assaulted, perhaps, was acted on by the criminal, isn't legally able to speak for themselves, and in C they're not physically able to speak for themselves because they're deceased. In either case, I think we would want the folks who could speak on their behalf to be pretty close to the same, one or two tiny differences. I would not, I guess, be inclined to open the list to be the victim's spokesperson to absolutely everyone in here, because we would draw your bill one heck of a fiscal note. I do think that it makes sense to have an adult able to give the victim impact statement when the person who was actually affected by the criminal can't, either physically or legally. And it makes great sense to me to expand that pool to two if there is a minor child whose parent can't speak for themselves. So an approach like that, I think, would accomplish your intent, because you have good intent with this bill. The underlying purpose of the bill makes great sense. I would think we'd want to keep one adult in the victim statement process, the probation process, speaking at sentencing and modification of sentencing process. So those are my thoughts here without drawing a giant fiscal note, because I don't want to do that to your bill.
Taylor, would you like to respond?
I'm not sure of the change. I may not have followed that. I'm sorry, Senator, to the chair that you were indicating to. Is that making a change to B2 as Senator Hughes was suggesting?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I haven't written it. So, but I would love the opportunity to work ideally with your office as well as Ms. Winston.
Okay. We're definitely taking amendments. We're gonna have a fairly quick turnaround on the bill. I hope, but we're definitely gonna take amendments like I do in every bill. I'm not changing the policy for myself. With that, is there any other questions today? Senator Myers.
Just a quick comment on the exchange that we've been having here on paragraph B. It seems to me that in paragraph B, what we're trying to do is establish some sort of guardianship, a relationship of guardianship for a perpetrator, or excuse me, for a victim of a crime who has not passed away. And so, while I understand a little bit of what the point that Senator Hughes has been driving at, that the person that which a crime has been committed to is not the only victim, I'd be hesitant to open it up to multiple people without first going through a pretty exhaustive list of what the victims' rights in Alaska are, and I need to do some research on that myself. Whereas what I'm looking at in terms of, let's say somebody was a victim of a crime and thereby made incompetent or incapacitated for medical reasons and a whole host of other reasons, I would think that if there wasn't already an obvious guardian in terms of a parent or a spouse, that the court would be appointing a guardian. And so I I would think that we don't necessarily that we don't need to open up that can of worms.
Okay, and we can debate this during amendment process. So,
this is a question.
Okay, Senator Hughes.
I guess I think what we need is clarification whether we are talking about these people as people that can submit an impact statement, people that are going to be guardians, people that are going to be eligible for monetary restitution. Can you tell us exactly? We've been talking about impact statements, but is a person who can give an impact statement, is that someone then who is eligible for restitution? And are we talking about assigning guardianship here? Or is that I don't think that's what this is about, but please clarify.
Taylor?
Oh. Yes, Senator Hughes, through the chair. This is Taylor Winston. The change that was, I guess, that we're discussing, but primarily the change in C-double-I was to allow a child of a homicide victim, regardless of age, to be able to have all the crime victim rights. So those entail, it's not appointing the guardian, it's not getting into guardianship statutes, but it is things beyond a victim impact statement. For example, does the 15-year-old want to be in the courtroom to watch the trial, even if they may be a witness to the event? Do they have restitution on their own? Some kind of, usually would probably fall to the guardian, you know, because they're getting counseling or other things, but there may be some level of restitution. Is there some sort of privacy right that perhaps the defense attorney, they're a witness to it, and the defense attorney is wanting to get into some private records, whether it be counseling records, school records, any number of records, which would be one of the things our office could participate in helping if the person's a victim under the definition of a victim. So there are a whole host of victims' rights in this state that a child of a homicide victim couldn't participate in or have access to given this. And in the case I had, it was specifically a child wanting to be in the courtroom for proceedings, which is a victim right. And the argument was they weren't an adult and they should be precluded from being able to be in that courtroom. That didn't seem right, and I don't think is right. So that's where the issue was spotted and actually came to fruition as a legal concern for our office.
Okay, so thank you, Taylor, for being with us today. I just want to get on the record once again that the whole goal of this bill was to allow a child of a homicide victim to have victim's rights. It literally was removing an adult and adding the word A. It is like deleting one word. So anything else you guys decide to amend the bill, you're basically changing what language is already in statute, which I'm not going to, you know, oppose, cause you guys, in regards to allowing the opportunity to bring it forward. But I'm just telling you this was just because of a pretty bad incident that happened, and we just want to make sure that this doesn't happen again. The court had been kind of overlooking it and a lot and allowing it, but in this case it didn't happen, and that's why it got brought to our attention, because we've been involved in victims' rights issue from the beginning of my legislature. Basically, this is my ninth year getting involved in this issue. But anyway, right now I'm going to go ahead and allow for a little bit of public testimony, because we did notice it. So I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony. And this is on SB 122 with that, Katie Botts.
Hello, can you hear me, Senator?
Yes, we can. Please proceed, you've got 2 minutes, and thank you for being with us, Katie.
Alrighty, my name is Katie Botts. I'm from Juneau, Alaska, and I am in full support of this bill. In previous years, I have been trying to speak up to legislators to be fully and solely victim-oriented. I ask that you guys are mindful that victims does include children, minors, and that they should have the right to be in court proceedings, and they should have the right to go through the process, especially when they've been victimized. It's not easy, personally, to be victim as a minor. I was sexually abused at the age of 12. And I just ask that all victims, no matter what the crime is, that they have equal representation in the courtroom and that they're able to proceed through the system however that they choose, whether or not that they wishes to be involved in the courtroom or wishes not to be involved. It is their life. It is how they can process what they've been through. And I ask that you keep the, I respectfully request that you guys keep it close-knit so that it doesn't open to everyone, but that you keep it solely on the main center of the victim, no matter who, what age that victim may be. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie, for being with us today. I'm going to go ahead for now and close public testimony. I may open it at a future time, but for right now, I'm going to go ahead and close it. And with that, I'm going to just take a very brief Eddie so my staff can come back and be in her seat up here. So just a quick brief Eddie. So we're going to go back on record and take up our last and final order of business today. SJR1, we heard public testimony. We dealt with amendments. I want to, Senator Wilikowski is dealing with the disaster bill, I know, in finance. I really wanted him here, but I know he's dealing with something really important. We do have his staff here, but I wanted to see if there's any final thoughts on SJR1 from the committee or from Kawasaki. I don't know if you want to just make a closing comment or something, and then I'm going to do the will of the committee.
Good afternoon, members of the Judiciary Committee.
We can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just a little louder.
Sorry, Madam Chair. My name is Sonia Kawasaki. I'm staff to Senator Bill Wilikowski. I don't really have any additional comments unless the committee members had questions. The senator has appreciated the support of the committee members on this resolution.
Okay. Looks like we don't have any comments, questions. With that, what's the will of the committee?
Can I have one brief one, Madam Chair?
Oh, sure. Senator Schauer.
Thank you. I just think it's important to know we've debated this for years. And this committee has gone through this before. This is deja vu. And I just want to highlight for the record, everybody here sitting at the table knows it, and I think the public is getting to this point of understanding it. We don't really have any time to kick the can down the road much more, if at all. Even with the COVID money coming in from the federal government that doesn't really exist since it's just printed. But we have to do something. Whether it's this solution, which drives us then to reductions and spending cap and taxes, because that's the dirty word, but it's coming. We need to do something. This is a part of the effort, Madam Chair, and whether it's this solution or one of the other ones being proposed, I just think it's important to put in the record and tell the public so they understand we know that something has to be done, because if we don't do something in the next year or two, we're drawing down our funds and then COVID money goes away and our economy is wheezing and we've got big problems. So I appreciate the sponsor bringing this up and being dogged in his pursuit of it, and I hope that we will find a solution this year as a body to do something so we can start taking the put the oxygen back in the room related to the PFT, and we can move on solving the other problems. I just want to put on the record, Madam Chair, say thank you for continuing to not give up on trying to find a solution. Thank you.
Senator Hughes.
Yes, and as late as it is in the session as well, so I think it's important to give a vehicle to the Senate Finance Committee, and I have said in at different points in the last few years, way back, I didn't support a constitutional amendment for this, the idea of painting us in a corner. But I've also been here, as you have been, Madam Chair, where this has been an issue of political football, essentially. It slowed things down. So I do support coming up with a decisive solution in the Constitution. So I do support passing this out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Kiel?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Like other members of the committee, I also appreciate the sponsor's hard work and constant effort on this. He has been an absolute champion of this. I agree that we need to put a constitutionalized PFD before the voters. I have some ongoing concerns about the formula in SJR1. I will continue to work with the sponsor as the bill moves through the process to address some of those. But I will not object to the bill moving out of committee today.
We appreciate that. And as I stated on record, I am definitely for allowing the people to have an input in this. We've been tossing this football around for, I don't know, 5-6 years, and now it's time to get the football out in the people's court. So with that, what is the will of the committee? Senator Schauer?
Madam Chair, I move the Senate Judiciary Committee move Senate Joint Resolution 1, Work Order 32-LS00154-alpha, as amended with accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations, be moved out of the Judiciary Committee.
And seeing no objections, the bill will move out of committee. If people can stay and sign paperwork, that would be appreciated. Thank you for your hard work, Ms. Kawasaki. We appreciate that, and congratulations. I want to put on record first right now that amendments for SB 122, the bill we just heard, are going to be this Friday at 5 o'clock, so we're given a couple days to do that. And then I want to remind everybody that SJR 4 is going to be at the committee before us on Friday. We may be working remotely. I have not made the decision yet in regards to that, but everybody knows I'm kind of done with these masks. And anything that I can do to avoid wearing this, pretty much. So I may take a page out of Senator Schauer's book. He'll have to, you know, cue me up on that. But I just wanted to put that on notice. But our main focus on Friday will be SJR4, which will be Senator Hughes presenting. We will have a few invited testimonies. And with that, we are going to gavel out right now at 2:50.